From 1966 to 68, Michael Nesmith was a singer and guitarist playing the role of a singer and guitarist on the TV series The Monkees. This program was about a rock and roll band, and the madcap antics the show tried for were inspired by the Beatles film A Hard Day's Night. When the TV series ended, Nesmith continued his performing career, but he's made the most impact as one of the first and most successful video entrepreneurs. Nesmith produced one of the first rock videos for his record Rio in 1977. He created the prototype for MTV. And his company Pacific Arts Video releases home videos and produces films. Nesmith financed the films Repo Man, Time Rider, and Tapeheads. His company has released on home video such films as My Dinner with Andre, The Official Story, and The Life and Times of Harvey Milk, as well as comedy, music, and experimental videos. Nesmith was able to become an entrepreneur with the help of the fortune he inherited from his mother, who invented liquid paper, the correction fluid. She sold it to Gillette in 1979 for close to $50 million. I asked Michael Nesmith if his interest in rock videos had any connection to the Monkees TV show or the film A Hard Day's Night.
No, I didn't, because I wasn't involved creatively much with the Monkees at all. I didn't really absorb a lot during that particular period of time. My interest in the music video form goes back really to the beginning of the form, which sort of started almost day and date with the first film. The first type of this format that I'm aware of was Paul Whiteman's King of Jazz.
Oh, I've seen that. Yeah.
Yeah. Where there was something else going on besides just the performance of the songs. And then, of course, there was the Hollywood musicals of the 40s and 50s, which were really the flowering of the form. To my mind, I don't think anybody's done it better than Disney. He really started off, I guess, in the late 30s and went on from there, probably hitting his stride in Fantasia. Some of it's awful corny, but some of it's just really inspired.
Your first video for one of your songs was in 1977 for your record Rio. And I was wondering what inspired you to do that beyond the movie production numbers and animated films like Fantasia that you've referred to.
Well, the impulse, or the reason that I did it was because in Europe at the time, the way the television systems were set up and the way records were promoted, they would take a picture of a popular artist singing their song and then bicycle that tape around the continent, and that was the way that artists got the exposure and people got to see the artists. So they asked, my record company asked if I would make them a tape like that, and I really sort of ignorantly didn't understand what they were asking for. And when they said, will you make a little film of your song, a little clip of your song, I thought that they were talking about something like Rio ultimately came out to be. When I took it over there and I presented it to the 30 promotion people that were assembled in a room, and they all stood up and cheered, I was as surprised as I was happy, because I didn't realize that it was such a departure from what they were expecting. And that was the reason that I did it. Why I worked in that form was what I explained to you a minute ago.
Mm-hmm. You created the prototype for MTV. You invented something called the Pop Clips, which was it a station devoted to rock videos?
Well, it was more than the prototype for MTV. It was the first broadcast of MTV. It was a show that I developed for, there was a combination of Warner Brothers and American Express and the cable channel, which you still see, the movie channel, and at the time they had an empty transponder. They had Nickelodeon that was broadcasting, and they had the movie channel, and they were looking for something to put on the empty transponder. And I said to them, and our paths crossed, and I said to them, well, I think that 24-hour day music programming can work.
Mm-hmm.
So we developed Pop Clips as essentially the pilot for MTV, and broadcast it initially on Nickelodeon, which was another service that they were providing for children. And the needle just went off the meter. So then we began to build MTV from you know, those sets and those all of those early pieces of shows and the legal stuff and the operation stuff and the administration stuff, and then they asked me if I wanted to stay and run it and work the channel for them, and I told them no, I didn't. I wanted to go on my way. So they paid me, and I moved on.
Why didn't you want to run it?
I felt like that there was a divergence in what I wanted to do with my career, and so I just made a decision that I was not going to really hit what I swung at there. So that it was a creative decision on my part, and in focusing in on what my objective was to be.
Michael Nesmith is my guest. He first became famous as one of the members of the Monkees. He now runs a very successful home video and film production company. Now, are you still producing rock videos?
No, I haven't made a music video in probably, 5 years.
What do you think of what MTV has become and what rock videos have become? Because in a way, they've become compulsory marketing tools for any rock band.
Well, I'm just not going to get into MTV bashing. Mm-hmm. It's too easy. They're obviously not doing they're not working to the potential of the form, but I'd rather talk about what the potential of the form is. This combination of music and film is something that I think we're going to see more and more emerge on the landscape of the arts. You just get lightning in a box. I think it was Ezra Pound that said that poetry is language charged with meaning. And the early filmmakers found out that music charged the film image with meaning. And I think artists work more to combining these forms, that the standalone rock and roll act who's taken a picture of their latest record in order to market it is probably not going to be a part of the scene. What's going to happen is you're going to see an entirely different type of artist emerge who is able to work in both forms very happily. And, as far as MTV's concerned, no, they're not doing that, but then they don't pretend to do that. And the people who show music videos don't pretend to show music videos. As far as whether or not that's a good or a bad thing, I'll leave that to you and the listeners to make up your own minds about.
I think some rock bands have control over what their videos are, and for them, a video is a very creative process. And for others, it's kind of out of their control, and they end up with a story that doesn't necessarily match their own concept for their song.
Well, it's not surprising. I mean, the forces that come to work in the contemporary business of rock videos is really not the forces that understand what the objective is. But, you have to treat it fairly. Because, a rock and roll band is essentially in the business of selling an audio representation of their music. They're not into selling the audio visual representation. Home video is probably going to give a life to the new type of record. Laserdisc is coming on stream very fast. The CDs already now have video capabilities in the new CDVs, and there's sort of the existence. Kind of a de facto visual image of some of these rock music that's out there, but it's going to help put in place a consumer base a world where the new art form can exist. So these people are just making they're all over the place. You've got a rock and roller on the one hand who knows nothing about film and a filmmaker who knows nothing about rock and roll. They come together, and what they're basically trying to do is make a commercial for a record. But as home video takes over and as it becomes an art form in and of itself, you're going to see more and more of the Disney-like things, more and more of the early musicals.
Michael Nesmith is my guest. I think a lot of people are aware of the fact that your mother was the creator of Liquid Paper, which was the first kind of brush on white fluid that would cover up typing errors. So I think you grew up without much money and ended up grown with a great deal of more money. Was there a big turning point in your life, the kind of before and after liquid paper period?
No. No, that really didn't. There was no big swing there. For one thing, to give you some perspective, liquid paper currently controls over 80% of the correction fluid market in the United States. It controls that really almost throughout the world, except Western Europe, where we have a very aggressive competitor that that controls the market. My mother started off with this product in the kitchen, and she and I filled fingernail polish bottles with ketchup and mustard dispensers that she had filled with the paint that she had matched to the paper that she was using at the office. And she took this idea of correction fluid from that beginning and turned it into a multi-million-dollar international corporation. Now that all sounds like you wake up one morning and you're rich. It took 25 years,
mm-hmm.
And it was a very slow, difficult process. Her first car was not a Rolls Royce, but her last car was, but it was. The unfolding of the idea over a period of time, and it was the logic of events, which is the mark of success, that pushed it along, was what happened in my life, and so it was just about like watching a tree grow. At what point did the tree grow in the back of the yard? That's do you really just don't have a basis for a question. There's not a threshold or a watershed in these types of things.
A lot of people, when they imagine what it would be like if they inherited a fortune, think that they'd stop working and just enjoy their money. You've never taken that approach, and you've remained very active in production and in business. Did you ever have that fantasy yourself of not working because you had money?
Well, no, it's absurd because I don't work for money. I mean, that's not why you work, is it?
Well, for a lot of people it is. For some people it's not.
Yeah, it's just a question of values.
Mm-hmm. What kind of music were you performing before you joined the Monkees?
I had learned to play the guitar and kind of followed the folk singers of the time. Kind of Dylan and Joan Baez there were a whole stack of people whose names don't even really count as much as those guys do anymore. And I was working on my own for a while, and then I started working with a bass player, and then ultimately we got a drummer. And by the time I got the job on the television show, I was working in a band of about six people that was kind of a folk revue.
No, I read that you sometimes performed under the name of Michael Blessing. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, the people, I made a record deal with some people at Columbia, of all places. The people at Columbia had no idea about the Monkees, and the people in the Monkees had no idea about Columbia, even though it was the same company.
They asked
me to change my name because they thought Nesmith was. Just not going to work on a record. So I made one record under the name of Michael Blessing. I picked it out of the phone book.
That's funny. Well, I want to talk with you more about your life and your music, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Michael Nesmith, and he's the only original member of the Monkees who didn't join their reunion tour last year. He's been busy with his home video and film production company, Pacific Arts. He created one of the first music videos in the 70s and developed a music video format, which became the pilot for MTV. His company has also produced such films as Repo Man and Tapeheads. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Michael Nesmith is my guest. Now, I believe that you auditioned for the Monkees after seeing an ad in Variety. And I was wondering what you had to do for the audition, what the audition was like.
It really was a very typical Hollywood audition. I met the producers. They talked to me a little bit about my experience. Would this thing have any interest for me? Could I play? What was I doing at the time? Then they asked me to come back for a screen test. I went back for a screen test. Essentially the same thing. There was a director on the other side of the camera doing a few questions, which I answered to the camera. And that was it. They gave me the job. I never read a part or anything.
During the production of The Monkees, is it true that Don Kirshner actually produced records of how The Monkees should sound, gave the records to the group, and then the group had to learn their parts off of the records and do their best to sound like the people on the records?
No, that's just a common misconception. Kirshner made a few records, and I made a few records, and Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart made a few records, and the music was really not even, nobody really thought too much about the music, except that we wanted it to be good and sort of positive and upbeat. They'd asked me to make a half a dozen records, they being the producers of the show. And so I made a half a dozen records, and then when the album was about to come out, they said, you know, we want to put all this music on here. And I said, well, why don't you just put a couple on, and that way it'll be a good broad sampling of all the music that's around. You know, later on, when the thing took off and surprised everybody, and we went out on tour, then we learned to play the songs that we hadn't played.
During the period of the Monkees, you seem to be the member of the group who was the most outspoken, and who would sometimes talk about how it wasn't really a band, and you weren't getting a chance to play your own music. Were you uncomfortable with the group while you were in it?
No, you're a media victim, and that's understandable, because I encounter this quite frequently. No, I wasn't unhappy there. It was a lovely experience. The television show worked good. It was an enormously successful series. The music was an added kicker. I think that everybody was very surprised that we were so straight up about the fact that the music was just a part of the television show. And there was a certain conceit at the time about rock and roll bands and what a rock and roll band was supposed to be, and because we were playing a rock and roll band on television, everybody just figured we were a rock and roll band. So when somebody stood up and said, "Well, wait a minute, that's don't mix your fantasy with reality here. We're just four guys who are essentially actors who have some musical skills," and so the press went off as if this was some kind of epiphany. I suppose that's fine. It's a little adrift from the truth. I wasn't outspoken, nor was I particularly unhappy.
Were you able to play and sing on your own records?
Oh yeah,
on the Monkees,
sure.
Records.
Well, to the degree that I wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't much want to.
Why not?
Well, it just wasn't my cup of tea.
What, the music wasn't?
No, like I said, I'd been a folk singer. I mean, I made maybe a half a dozen records, and then we all got together and played some and everything. But, at the end of the day, it wasn't a rock and roll band, was it?
Right. When the Monkees show ended and the group split up, what did you do immediately?
Well, wait a minute. You mean the group didn't split up? It was never a group.
Right.
When the show ended,
right.
Well, I just went back to making music. I was real curious about maybe expanding into the country format, and I made some country records and started a small studio in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. You had Linda Ronstadt had a hit with your song Different Drum in 1967.
Yeah, well, I must say Linda did more for that song than that song did for Linda. She was, she really... I think really you have to go into the Peter Asher management period to justifiably say that that was her first hit. I think her first hit was a remake of a rock and roll song. But I was glad that Linda recorded Different Drum, and I was glad that a lot of people heard Linda's record of Different Drum. But if you listen to Linda's record of Different Drum and you listen to my record of Different Drum, you if you're anything like me, you prefer Linda's by orders of magnitude. So.
Did people associate you with that and make the connection between the Michael Nesmith of the Monkees and the Nesmith who wrote the song?
Well, only to occasionally send letters, angry letters, saying, "Did you know that that guy from the Monkees is taking credit for Linda's song?" Excuse me. They did the same thing about "Mary Mary," a song which I wrote that the Butterfield Blues Band recorded. This was so ironic. to, I guess, the Butterfield Blues fans. They wrote mad letters to Jack Holtzman, who was the head of Elektra, who forwarded them on to me with his reply, which was, sorry, guys, he wrote it. Now, did you know Mary Mary is in Run DMC's new single?
Were you surprised when most of the all the members of the Monkees, except for you, reunited recently for a reunion tour? The band that was never a band became a band.
Well, no, because we toured. You know, when we were when the show was on, we, you know, took a band out and took our instruments out and went up and played, and it was a lot of fun. Those were nice moments. But I wasn't surprised because they had been kind of, you know, hatching the idea for about a year, and I had been trying to work my schedule around so that I could go out with them. When they finally got the dates put into place, it had gone from just a few dates on a few weekends to like 200 dates or something because, it was so incredibly popular. And that's when I had to fall out because I said, you know, guys, I can't commit to that block of time. So we worked it out so I could play with them when they came into Los Angeles, and that was it.
My guest is Mike Nesmith. I want to talk to you a little bit more about home video, which is what your company does, among other things. Have you been able to notice any habits that you could generalize about what kinds of movies people actually buy as opposed to rent?
Well, are you talking about market research on the types of movies that sell through?
I mean, about your personal experiences with your own company. I'm assuming here that you do rentals and sales. Is that right?
Well, I exist way up the stream.
Uh-huh.
We focus more on software. We produce and manufacture and distribute, but we don't have any activity at the retail or rental level at all.
Right,
we just sell to those people who do.
Who do, right. So, but you have to keep tabs on what their sales are, right?
Yeah. No, I don't think that there's a... Repo Man was a good example. Repo Man was an absolute disaster at the box office, and yet this thing is almost 200,000 units as far as sell-through. There seems to be a type of movie that people just want to own. The first video that I did, Elephant Parts, has sold quite a bit, and it never saw the light of day. I mean, video was its own window. I think in order to perceive correctly of home video, you have to think of it as its own thing, and to think of it as being a medium for used movies, and to try to figure out what used movies people are going to see is to really miss the point of it.
But you do that a lot.
Well, not too much. If you take a look at the catalog, I own all the... I do happen to have the video rights to My Dinner with Andre, and I happen to have the video rights to my own films. Outside of that, I move into a different area. You know, we have, for instance, the definitive biography on Martin Luther King. We've got all the Jacques Cousteau films. I've got Agatha Christie Mysteries as a series. Really, I approach the video business as the book business.
What made you realize when you were getting started in home video that there was going to be a market there? You got started before most people owned video cassette recorders.
Well, it's a confluence of events, and just in life, you see the computer coming together with communications, coming together with entertainment, and you see all these. There is a profound change that seems to be occurring in just the way we live our life. And if you look at home video and you look at the VCR and you look at the video cassette, you see that one of the things that it provides is an ability to program your own time. And anything that's going to move you beyond the tyranny of time is going to move you really very quickly into the stream where you feel these merging forces that I just mentioned. And once you start to feel those merging forces, you realize you can have a lot more fun doing that than if you're out doing the things that you've been doing all along, such as watching free television. And in addition to being able to allow the consumer to watch what they want when they want, I think that this medium also, it looks like it's going to be a distribution medium for types of properties and types of artworks that, number one, haven't even been defined yet, and number two, will have a completely different support base in the form of advertising. This is something that sends a lot of people screaming from the room, but it's just the writing on the wall. I mean, there's going to be ad-supported home video, and I think it's going to be a very salutary thing. I'm not talking about putting an ad in the middle of Treasure of the Sierra Madre. I'm talking about, you know, an ad for Motorcraft and Purelator products on the latest drag racing tape. And, you know, to a lot of people, and oddly enough, to the media more than almost anyone else, this is a hidden phenomena. We're selling millions of tapes, and we're making millions of dollars on a consumer base that has 65 million VCRs in place, representing, you know, 130, 140 million people in this country. And it's more and more people are using this video to watch things, but they're not watching used movies. They're looking for these book-like products. And so you see the Sports Illustrated tapes and the Jane Fonda tapes, and you see the tapes like that come along, and they go up into numbers that are astronomical, and it doesn't seem like anybody even knows that that's happening. Movies are just really not a part of what video is all about.
Well, let me just ask you this. Have you ever thought of distributing the videos of the old Monkey shows, buying up the rights to that?
They're already out on Columbia. I've thought about it. I would like to put out Head, because I think that was a good film. And I'm probably going to put my television show out, Television Parts. Recycling television shows is about the same as recycling movies. It doesn't, you know, you really don't speak to the form. It's not until you speak to the form and you understand where it sits in this in the new technologies that you really start to do any good. And otherwise, you're just brokering old stuff. Turn into an antique dealer. I'm not interested in that.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your work. Thank you.
Okay.
Michael Nesmith is the head of Pacific Arts Video. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.